Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. This is episode 7. Today is Wednesday, March 23rd. And it's not morning, it's just in the afternoon. Good afternoon, Scott.
Good afternoon, Matt.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
It's snowing out today.
Wah, wah.
They're talking about a foot of snow today. So all those 70 degree days we had a couple weeks ago, all for naught.
I don't buy it. I don't believe the hype. It's not going to snow. Well, it's going to snow, but not a foot.
It's clearly going to snow because it is snowing.
So. The more snow that is predicted and the further in advance it's predicted, the less likely it is to actually happen, in my experience.
The wisdom of Scott.
Yeah.
Who does not believe in climate prediction models of any kind.
Nope.
Well, I guess we'll know by tomorrow how much it's going to snow. So, there we go. So we should dive right in. Where do you want to start? Any particular topic catch your eye?
We could start with Adventure Roulette.
Okay. Adventure Roulette. So, the basic premise is you show up at the airport and you find the most interesting looking, least harried airline ticket agent to go up to and say, book me a round trip flight to somewhere for less than $500. And they ask you where, and you say, I don't care, anywhere you want to take me. And once you get through the bizarre look on their face, they give you a plane ticket. And you go. And you figure out what to do when you get there. So, found a blog post about this. And my immediate reaction was, you know, this is interesting. I think it would be fun. And so I emailed it to you. And your immediate reaction was, no.
No, thank you.
Effing way. Yeah. So, what does that say about us, right? That I find the unknown destination interesting to me and that you would find it not.
And, you know, I had two real hangups with this. The first one is the idea of walking up to the ticketing agent and saying, you know, pick a ticket. I think you would see incredible friction on that idea and pushback and outright refusal to do that. And I think that's probably a good idea on their behalf. Because there's probably some liability involved in them essentially sending you to some destination that was not of your choosing. That's what I would be thinking if I were the ticketing agent. I can't be responsible for putting this guy on a plane that may crash or putting him in a destination where he may get, you know, robbed or murdered.
What liability could there be? You're still choosing to spend the money.
True. I just feel like there's gray area there. I think you're going to find a lot of ticketing agents that just refuse to do it. So there it's like immediately your adventure is like curtailed by some pencil pusher at an airport.
Well, I think that's where the spending a moment to try to find the right ticket.
The right.
Right. Like, you know, find somebody who's not in the middle of having a bad day. I think you got to find somebody who's having a good day. Because then a little bit of pleasant conversation, especially if it's not super busy. This article talked about going to the airport at a period of time where it is not busy, right? If there's the crush of humanity at the airport and things are miserable, you're being, you know, the jerk.
Right. You're the problem.
But if the airport isn't super busy and you have some time to have a minute or two of conversation with this ticketing agent, and they're not having, you know, some horrible day, you know, once you engage them in conversation, they'll be more amenable to your adventure. And maybe even wish that they could have an adventure like that themselves. So what's the other thing you don't like about it?
I have a lot of places that I want to go that I've never been. So I already have a list of spots I'd want to spend, you know, 24 or 48 hours in. So why wouldn't I just pick the place that is the cheapest ticket or the most convenient or whatever? Well, just do that.
That's fine. How come we're not doing that?
Yeah. Okay.
Where do you want to go?
I don't know. I've never spent any time in Boston. I've never spent any time in Portland, Seattle. Like, just pick. I could, you know, give you 10 American cities that I would like to spend a weekend in imminently. Why wouldn't I just pick one of those instead of ending up in, you know, Fayetteville, Arkansas or something?
Because the ticketing agent's grandmother lives in Fayetteville. Yeah. Well, maybe we should record a podcast on the road. How about that?
I'd be down.
Okay.
So that was my main hang up. Like, why wouldn't I pick a place that I've always wanted to go to cross off my list rather than some random place determined by the ticketing agent?
Fair enough.
But it removes some of the adventure, right? That there's no adventure in knowing your destination. Well, that's the point of the adventure roulette concept, right?
Maybe not. I think the real value of the adventure roulette concept is it allows for you to find joy in the unexpected. But at the same token, if you say, I'd like to go spend a couple of days in Seattle, that's okay as long as you haven't, you know, spreadsheet budgeted your time, all 48 hours you're going to spend in Seattle, like down to the minute, right? That's no fun at all.
Okay. So the compromise is maybe we each pick 5 cities.
Okay.
And put them in a hat.
And pick one and go.
Pick one and go. Well, at the airport.
If you're going to do that, why wouldn't you, you know, create a query that's, what does it cost for tickets from here to there?
Okay, yeah, just sort it.
And then every
week, ascending order and pick the top one.
Right.
I'm cool with that too. I think what makes it the adventure is no prior planning and, you know, even maybe being in the airport before you make the decision.
Well, some stuff is prior planned. Like if you go to Seattle, you say, man, I really want to go to the Space Needle, if that's what you want to do, right? Maybe you don't.
Yeah, but you're not, like, getting tickets to stuff. You're not...
Right.
...booking a hotel room in advance.
Yeah, that the internet has made the hotel room problem trivially easy. So...
To be honest, too, you probably end up spending less. It probably ends up being a less expensive trip with modern last-minute, you know, hotel technology and last-minute stuff.
It could be.
To end up spending less than if you had booked your hotel in advance and gotten a rental car and, you know, we're just going to show up and use hotel tonight and take Uber.
Right. Some people don't enjoy that level of uncertainty. My girlfriend she is a big believer in travel. She is not a big believer in last minute travel accommodations. So the idea that you would show up somewhere and not have a place already picked out to sleep can be hard for her. If it's booked 3 days in advance, that's fine. She just has the certainty of,
right,
I've committed myself to this trip and I know where I'm sleeping.
Yeah.
That's
fair.
Different people, right?
If you do this last minute stuff, eventually you're going to get burned because you're going to end up somewhere where there's multiple conferences in town, there's no rooms available.
Yeah, but everybody's brilliant travel story at any party you've ever been to doesn't involve the time they went somewhere and stayed, you know, at a nice hotel and nothing crazy happened. Right? It always involves the, you know, we went somewhere and something bizarro happened and then we did crazy stuff. Like, we had no place to sleep, so we stayed up all night and spent a couple hours in Denny's and, you know, were crazy tired the next day, which made ziplining at 2 o'clock in the afternoon kind of surreal. But then that night we finally had a place to sleep and everything was fine. All right. We're going to do this cities in a hat thing.
What did I just commit to?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of it. You don't know.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about Google and Go. And not the computer language. Although the computer language is interesting.
You know, that's, I hadn't thought about that till right now. That's an interesting search engine problem. If people were Googling Google Go, you know, to hear about this story.
To find the link I put in our document, I did Google it, and the first 20 of them were about the programming language. So then I had to change my search terms.
Google, like, marketing people were probably very unhappy with the language naming people at this point in time.
Maybe. It's hard to imagine Google being that big, but I guess it's big-ish now. In any case, so Google has an AI, which I think they were using a neural network, a self-learning neural network, to play Go, and it played one of the top-ranked Go players in all of the known universe in Beverly Hills in... did that take place in Korea? In Seoul? I don't remember. The and the Google AI, of course, won 4-1 out of the 5 games played, even though it was a best of 5 series. And so the the question is, what does this mean? I can remember, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago now, when IBM's Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov playing chess, right? And so Go is a much more difficult game for a computer to do than chess is, just because the number of moves are much larger. And yet here we have the computer who's done it. It either means the end times are upon us, or things are about to get really amazing. Maybe a little bit of both. What do you think? Do you think it's significant?
I've never played Go before. Have you ever gotten into Go or played much Go?
No, I have not.
So I don't totally understand the complexity of the game. I feel like we should learn to play Go.
Well, undoubtedly, there's an Easter egg on google.com somewhere where you probably could play Go in JavaScript. Yeah. If not, then maybe some brilliant Google engineer needs to spend his 20% time and make that happen.
So what was most interesting about this to me is the analysis of the computer's play, and that at points in the games, it would do something that a human would never do. Mm-hmm. And that the commentator, that was interesting to me too, that they had commentators.
Right. That's just one of those unique jobs for which you think, why does this exist?
Yeah. Right?
Like, I can see it in your face. You're like, who gets a job being a Go commentator?
Yeah.
Well, somebody does.
So anyway, at the time the computer made the move, the commentators, you know, had no explanation for it. Like, they couldn't conceive why this move was being made, and then it turned out that that was the pivotal move,
right?
You know, that caused an effect that ultimately allowed the computer to win. So that's really interesting to me, that now when you've had this analysis done of what, you know, the best way to win is, now our professional Go players, is it going to influence how humans play Go?
How,
because now we have the data, better data of how to win the game.
Well, the Go players who have played the computer during the development, in the lead up to this, have stated that it has made them a better player. I remember reading somewhere that one of the guys that was helping them do it was ranked in the 600s in the world when the computer was able to start beating him regularly. And by continuing to play and get beat most of the time by the computer, he got better. And I believe he's now ranked in the 300s in the world because it has made him a better Go player. And I think the gentleman who's... I'm not very well prepared. The gentleman who actually lost in this match, I think, came out and said that these matches have given him a lot to think about and will undoubtedly make him a better Go player in the world. But it doesn't, you know, the ability of the computer to play a bazillion games against itself and do some analysis to determine which ones are better than others doesn't strike me as surprising. I mean, I once wrote a program, it was a horrible piece of code, but it was a learning, it was a simple artificially intelligent program to play tic-tac-toe. This was a project I did in college. And once you have some code to do this, when this code was horrible because I was 20, then you have to say, well, how do you train it so that it can become, how can it learn to play tic-tac-toe in the optimal way? Well, I wrote essentially, it was a random, but an opponent that could play my artificial intelligence program, and I let it run for a weekend. And I came back in and, on Monday, and that it had played literally every game of tic-tac-toe that can be played. And then my artificial intelligence program could play me to a draw every time. I mean, so obviously the computer can play itself, even if it's playing a random opponent. It can do so many games so fast that it can eventually see enough games that it can determine an optimal path through. Like, the hard part for all of this stuff, like the hard part for chess was always, can you do it on the 3-hour play clock or whatever that you have? And I assume that was the hard part here, right?
Right, the speed at which the analysis can happen.
Right. Which speaks to algorithmic improvements.
Right.
I mean, over 20 years, how much faster has computer hardware gotten, really, compared to the algorithmic improvements? So
that's something that was very different from, you know, the last time we've gone through this man versus computer thing kind of was the Watson on Jeopardy thing.
Right.
And there it's just, right, like, how fast can I access data? Mm-hmm. But there's no strategy, right? Like, the human isn't going to learn how to answer questions faster because the computer did. So there's really nothing to be learned from, like, a gaming strategizing standpoint from Watson.
Right.
You know?
Well, Watson's brilliance was in the natural language processing advancements, right? So... And then, obviously, they had information retrieval going on the back end, too. I mean, it's still, you can say, oh, I'm going to search the internet, but that's still a hard problem to sort out. So, I don't know. I thought it was interesting. And, you know, maybe it means that we're right on the precipice of our having to come to terms with accepting our robot overlords.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I play Bridge, and Bridge is one of those games that, like, there's pretty good AI that you can play for Bridge, but it's still very rules based.
Yep.
Whereas when you're actually playing Bridge with individuals, you know, there's a little bit of reading the player, you know, understanding how they play that goes into it. That's something that, you know, I don't know if that's a next step. Right. Can they have the computer start learning on an individual player basis? Right. I'm going to play this guy. I have some way to analyze 1,000 games that he's played. Can I start playing the player?
Sure. Well, it's almost like, you know, batters and pitchers in baseball. Right. I mean, they are constantly trying to analyze how they behave in certain situations. Right. Or in poker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Play the people in the room, not your cards in your hand, right? So, I don't know. That's an interesting
thing.
So the
point at which it can do that, that's when I get afraid.
But if it can already build a Terminator, why do you care?
Yeah, well, yeah. I know a few people who are kind of anti anti-AI right now and anti-robot, anti-driving car, self-driving cars, because of, you know, this eventual...
Well, hasn't...
computers take over the world scenario?
Hasn't Elon Musk famously come out in some doom and gloom about artificial intelligence and the dangers that it poses?
Yeah, and I'm not willing to, you know, I don't say that's completely invalid. I mean, maybe that's a valid concern. I don't think that's a valid concern today. So at this point in time, to start throttling scientific advancement, you know, to prevent that from happening, I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, well,
I think we're still at full steam ahead point. But that's the thing. Well, I guess what if you decide too late that you've hit the point of...
Humanity's history is littered with, I made a thing, I don't understand what that is until after some consequence has occurred. Right? Everything is that way. You know, I made a gasoline engine. Oh, brilliant. What does that mean? It means we can move easily, have a bazillion auto accidents, and cause, you know, worldwide climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, damn. Wish I'd thought of that first. So, true. Of course, you know, we're going to build AIs to do things before we really understand what that means. That's just how human beings work. Okay. Next thing. All right, so let's talk about something. I don't know if it's more, well, it's, maybe it's more serious, but I read this article in the Washington Post that was talking about 5 myths about heroin. We don't have to talk about them all in detail or even linger on this topic very long, but I thought it was an interesting set of myths, and I found it enlightening for different reasons, right? But the the thing that the one that was probably most important or most interesting to me was myth number 4, which is tough love is the only one that works. So if you've ever had somebody in your life who's been a heroin addict, you know, you'll know that they can, you know, any addict can completely suck the life out of you. Right, because they're very needy, addicted individuals. And so a common way to treat, especially heroin addiction, is, you know, a tough love sort of model, which involves, you know, effectively cutting yourself off from them, which to some extent you have to do to protect yourself, right? And then at some point, usually when they hit bottom, they'll be ready and want to get help, and then they can be helped. But there's some research that's starting to suggest that, you know, maybe there is an alternative model that can do things to help people with their addiction before that happens, right? And so this particular article talks about, you know, setting up a place where not all heroin addicts, but most heroin addicts use a needle to inject the drug, right? Setting up a place where they can go and use heroin and for free get a clean needle. And then there's... if they have an overdose, there are drugs that can be administered to counteract the overdose. where if they are there and they're using heroin and they have an overdose, then the drug can be administered to them to undo the overdose. And all of this is done in a kind of a non-judgmental sort of way. Because you can't change an addict from the outside. They have to want to change. This is true not just about a heroin addict, but anybody, right? I mean, you know, you and I both know, right? You're going to be overweight until you decide, you know what? I'm going to have a salad and not a cheeseburger, and I'm going to get on the treadmill and not sit on the couch, right? Once you internally have decided to make those changes, then, you know, with, especially if you have people helping you, you can make those changes, right? It's true for lots of things, right? But the having these places that you could maybe argue is enabling, but having these places where people can do this stuff that they're going to do anyway, but do it in the least dangerous way possible, you can minimize the bad outcomes, you know, of people dying or violence or whatever, right? And then when they're ready, there's somebody right there that's willing to get them into the treatment they might need. I don't know. It seemed...
That seems like a very interesting concept. It assumes that the person will be ready to change at some point, and at some reasonable point, right? Yep. Are we going to enable their heroin use for 6 months, you know, for a year, for 5 years? That is the kind of the sticking point. Well, at what point will the person be ready, and how long are we willing to wait?
Are you really enabling it? Yeah. It's not like you're going to buy the drugs for them.
Yeah.
You're not going to give
you're
the drugs to
them. You're just essentially protecting them.
That's the theory. It's tough.
It really makes sense. And if you could guarantee, you know, within a certain period of time, this person will be ready, you know, this person will take the steps to improve, I think it seems like an ideal, you know, situation. I think the problem is
it's hard to imagine
never are ready.
Yeah. Well, the part that I always struggle with is that basic idea seems it's counterintuitive, and it seems very unlikely to get any kind of support in America's current political environment. Right. Even if you figured out a way to have a place like this without any public money, right? If it was all private donations that was running a place like this, I feel like there would still be calls for, you know, these people are in possession of illegal drugs and you know where they are. You should just arrest everybody walking in the door.
Right.
And I can't argue that that's wrong. I don't know if it's beneficial, but it's clearly, you know, not outside the bounds of what's considered legal. I don't know. I found it an interesting idea. I found all of the things in this article an interesting thing. And I mostly just wanted to talk about it just briefly so we could put it in the show notes and maybe other people could, think about it on their own time.
Yeah, no, it mentioned, talked about rehab too. And I mean, that's related. Like the current concept is that, you know, we can fix you in a fixed period of time with a cold turkey approach, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. So the idea of we have a phased approach where you continue to use under supervision, you know, how long does that take for you to get there is really interesting.
Yeah, it's, people who have this problem, they have a lot of problems, right? And I think it says a lot about humanity that you know, at least on some level, we're willing as a society to figure out how to help these people.
And it's interesting that's starting to get some more political traction in the current election and in past elections. You know, regardless of how politically you lean, there are candidates saying, you know, drug addiction, drug abuse is a problem. It's a medical condition. We need to treat it as such. You know, we need to stop just putting people in jail.
Well, certainly, I mean, if you run jails, it's been good business for you. But as a society, it's fair to ask the question, and we got a lot of people in jail, more than other countries seem to have. Have we made the right choices here? Are the things that are criminal, you know, go to jail offenses, are those the right things? Maybe they are. Maybe they are. I'm not trying to make an argument either way.
It's worth having a conversation better yeah. approaches. And, you know, I hope that continues to gain some political steam.
Yes.
Just, I mean, from a helping people perspective, B, cost savings perspective.
Yeah, as a taxpayer.
Right.
It's an important question to ask, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about something more interesting. So this Apple and the FBI saga keeps getting weirder. So last minute, right, just before Apple's ready to go and testify, the FBI says, nah, never mind. A third party that we're not going to name has come forward with a technology that we're not going to talk about that says that that makes us believe that we can now get access to the data on the phone. So we don't need Apple's help anymore, maybe. So we want to cancel the court stuff, to which the judge said yes, and give me a report in 2 weeks or whatever, right? Sometime mm-hmm. in April. And so, you know, that immediately brings to mind two different but related questions, right? The first one about why, you know, either this is really true, in which case, who are these people and what is their technology?
Yeah.
Right? Is this, are they exploiting some bug in Apple's software? And does Apple know about it and can Apple fix it? And then does the FBI or does our government bear responsibility to share this flaw with Apple? I think they do. Or two, did the FBI recognize that maybe they were going to go to court and lose badly? And so they've had this kind of back pocket plan the whole time as an escape hatch for, you know, we're abandoning this all writs approach, which, you know, it could be because I'm a tech guy and kind of live in this tech bubble that maybe it felt to me like the world was overwhelmingly against the FBI. But I don't know, right? Part of the conspiracy theorist in me wants to believe the FBI knew it was going to lose, and so they've made this crap up as an escape valve. And maybe we'll never hear anything about it again. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this was a case to test the waters. This is a case that they wanted, you know, they wanted a verdict in court and in public opinion that they were right. And I think they saw the tables turn, that they weren't going to get what they wanted.
Well, the Department of Defense came out and said, back doors are not the right answer, right?
Right.
Former heads of the CIA and the NSA have said, back doors are not the right answer. That makes America weaker. I don't know. Yeah, President Obama, I think, was on the wrong side of this one, right? Thinking that there's some sort of middle ground here.
Mm-hmm.
One more disappointment on my long list of disappointments with President Obama. Which, to be honest, we can pick any president in my lifetime on this planet, and I can share with you my long list of disappointments.
Yeah. No, that's kind of my feeling. Like, I don't think in the last week they miraculously came up with some technology for cracking the phone that they were unaware of before. Whether this thing does exist and they had it in their back pocket, or it doesn't really exist and they just, you know, have...
They said whatever they needed to say.
Yeah, because there have been other kind of inadvertent statements about whether or not there is actually anything on this phone that's usable. I mean, to me, it was up for debate whether they really want access to this phone or not, or it's just they want a decision.
I think they were looking for the precedent.
Yes. I would agree with that, that they were looking more for the precedent than they were looking for the actual data. And if that's the case, then whatever this other technology is to get the actual data still is kind of moot, you know, if they don't really care about the data anyway. So, yeah.
So the saga continues.
Yeah.
All right. Well, since we're talking about Apple, on Monday, before they were supposed to go to court,
yeah,
they had a product announcement.
Did you watch the whole event?
Yes.
So Tim Cook actually had, you know, it was a little veiled. He didn't come out right and say, you must support us against the FBI. But he had a little speech about privacy and about Apple's commitment. And, you know, it was also of gratitude, you know, for people's support for what Apple's doing. I thought it was pretty well done. And it was, I mean, very obvious what he was talking about and Apple's commitment to it.
I think when Apple has an event like that, I think they can't not talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. Then it would be the elephant in the room. If they didn't talk about it, that's all anybody would talk about, is the fact that Apple didn't talk about their, you know, ongoing, I don't know if feud is the right word, but this ongoing thing with the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had to talk about it. And he did. And then, you know, people clapped and we got on with the business of saying, look at this new iPad with the stupid camera bump. Man, I'm so ready for a new iPad. But the fact that it has a camera bump, it's the thing I most thoroughly dislike about my phone. And it's the thing I'm fixated on this new iPad. I mean, yes, it has the screen that can work with the pencil, and you know, you can get the pencil, and there's the smart accessory dock thingy. I forget what its name is, and they've got a keyboard for it, and it's literally the most advanced display they've ever put in any device ever, you know, it's even better than the 13-inch iPad Pro's screen, which I think is brilliant, right? And they've come back around to low reflectivity being valuable, which is fantastic, because I've never liked any of Apple's stupid glossy displays.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the four speakers, and it's got all of this brilliant stuff, and the thing I'm fixated on is that stupid camera bump.
Yeah, I think it's interesting they didn't just make it a little thicker, because the big iPad Pro doesn't have the bump. Like, why didn't they just make it a little thicker and put
it doesn't have the same
in?
Camera.
Oh.
The big iPad Pro has a lesser camera. It has the 8-megapixel camera, right?
So when they, but it's a little bit thicker too. Like, that's always weird to me too. So now the like cheaper, smaller version of this product line has a better camera than the, you know, the like best version. And they did refresh the storage capacity in the big iPad Pro.
256.
So I can't believe that they wouldn't put the better camera in there, or they aren't planning on doing that. And if they do that, is it going to have a bump, or is it thick enough that it won't?
Yeah, I don't.
It's a little bit thicker, so
I don't know. I'm just looking up which camera. Yeah, the 12.9-inch iPad Pro has the 8-megapixel camera, which is the same one that's on the iPad Air 2, which was the camera that existed at the time they shipped it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the 12-megapixel camera that's on the 6S phones shipped after that, I believe.
I have to be honest, though, I think you're a little fixated on the bump, especially on the iPad. I hear you on the phone. If you're not going to put the phone in a case and you're going to slide it in and out of your pocket, any protrusion on the otherwise smooth surface
is
unfortunate.
Even their product video shows people setting the iPad down on a flat surface.
I guess you set it flat on the surface.
Like drawing Chinese characters on it. I mean, wouldn't it?
You're going to be able to push on the corners and just go wobble.
Maybe. I just, it's one of those things that just, it seems so obviously wrong.
It's interesting, the drawing. I hadn't thought about that. I was thinking, you know, you're holding your iPad in your hand, on your lap, whatever. Like, you're not putting it in your pocket. Why does it matter?
You could almost
laying
argue,
it flat on the table, it does matter.
Yeah, you could almost argue that it matters even less on the phone, because so much more of the usage of the phone is in your hand.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill.
It is such an odd design decision, though, for somebody who cares so much about clean lines, smooth surfaces, to have a protrusion on the back of the device.
It almost feels like a if Steve Jobs were alive moment, right? Like, yeah. If Steve Jobs were alive, he would not have the camera bump. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe yeah. I'm just an old fuddy-duddy, like, telling people to get off my lawn, but...
So now does the iPad, so this is the same size, the new smaller iPad Pro is mm-hmm. the same size as the iPad Air.
Yes.
So does that mean now the iPad Air line is frozen, like it's stranded now, there will never be, I mean, this is the new full size iPad.
Yes.
There will never be an iPad Air 3 or a next one in that lineup.
Right.
So what does that mean for you? You were in the market for potentially a new iPad, right? Would you go for, if you could get past the camera bump, do you have any interest in the Pro, or now are you just going to upgrade to an iPad Air 2 and be done with it?
If there was no camera bump, I would already be, I think...
Pre-orders tomorrow.
Pre-orders tomorrow. I'd be ready to fork over all of my monies for the iPad Pro. That there is the camera bump gives me pause. Mm. Now I have to go see it. Right? I'm going to wander into an Apple store and set the damn thing down on their table and mess with it and determine how much pain the camera bump is going to cause me.
I mean, from like a physical, aside from just aesthetics and function, aren't you more likely to scratch the lens? Because of how it is?
I don't know. The phone travels with me everywhere, right? Most of my iPad usage is just around the house, right? It's just a replacement for the laptop. So maybe you could argue that I would use less. It would be less likely to get scratched simply because it spends most of its time traveling, you know, between the office and the couch. So, I don't know.
Well, I think it's cool. I'm not an iPad person. I've never owned an iPad. I'm happy just taking my laptop everywhere. So I'm unlikely to be, I mean, I'm not persuaded by this to get one. I would love to play with the Pencil.
Yeah.
So selfishly, I think you should get one so I can play with it.
And spend $100 on the Pencil.
Yeah, because I think that's cool. I would be interested to play with that, but... I don't really have a use case for the iPad. And I actually, you know, I listen to a few podcasts where people use the iPad Pro and they're constantly talking about how they cram everything they do. They go to great lengths to cram their workflow
onto the iPad.
And I find it comical. Like, I feel like that's an Apple fanboy jump the shark moment when you have this elaborate... you know, Rube Goldberg machine of tooling that makes it so you can do your job on an iPad.
Yeah.
Get a grip. And a laptop.
Yeah, buy a MacBook and be done. Right?
So I don't have a lot of respect for that idea.
There are lots of things that you can do on an iPad that are fundamentally more pleasing to do there than on a laptop. So, if you've ever read a book on an iPad, you'll immediately understand how much more beneficial that is than trying to do it on a laptop. I find watching Netflix to be way more interesting on an iPad than on a laptop, just because there's just less stuff, right? I don't have the thing sitting on my legs or on the table or whatever. With the addition of the Pencil, you know, that you could draw right on the screen is way more interesting than drawing on a Wacom tablet.
Yeah.
Right. I have used a Wacom tablet in the past, and they're kind of neat. But after you use one for a while, you're like, I just wish I could draw right on the screen, right? So there are lots of things that are more natural on an iPad. Not everything, though. And I think iOS still has a ways to go before it's a real desktop replacement, though Apple tried to make that argument.
That was really interesting to me, that they were saying replace your junky old Windows laptop with an iPad Pro.
But for most people, I think that argument makes a lot of sense, right? What do most people do on their junky old Windows machine, right? Internet and email. And what can you do very effectively on an iPad? Internet and email. And some people say, oh, I also edit, you know, some Word documents. Microsoft has excellent editions of Microsoft Office available on the iPad. So, you know, it's clear, you know, Microsoft isn't getting any upgrade money from these people buying a new copy of Windows, right? Because they've got their five-year-old, you know, Windows XP or Windows 7 machine. I'm sure they'd love to sell them a new copy of Office. They'd love to sell them a new copy of Office on Windows 10, but at minimally, they'd love to sell them a new copy of Office. Okay. It's not the craziest argument. For a lot of people with simpler needs, that's fine.
It seemed like an odd marketing angle to me.
Well, what else are they going to do?
Yeah.
They're going to stand up on stage and say, hey, we made this new thing, and it's just like the thing we came out with 6 months ago, only smaller. I mean,
pushed the upgrade story, not just from people with cruddy old Windows laptops, but they basically were saying everyone who has an iPad should upgrade to this one.
I know. I have an iPad 3. I know a bunch of people with iPad 2s. I know one person with an iPad. They didn't call it the iPad 4. It was the new iPad, the one after my 3. And that's it, right? I take that back. I do know one person with an iPad Air 2, but they upgraded that from an iPad 3, I think. They were like me. But I know way more people with old iPads that still work fine for what they do.
Yeah.
Than I do people with new iPads. I know a lot more people with new phones than I do old phones.
I feel this is the first time they've directly pushed the you should upgrade your iPad now, like, marketing line. I don't know if that's a hint of desperation in the sagging iPad business. But I've never seen language quite that strongly telling you,
buy a new
upgrade. Yeah. Yeah. We know you already have one.
Right. This one's better.
Yes.
Well, Apple knows. I mean, they know, you know, when you log into the Apple Store and download updates, they know who's connected to what. They don't tell me those numbers. It'd be wonderful to know what those numbers are.
They talked a lot about the recycling angle, too, which I know you've mentioned your intentional decision to not upgrade your phone as often. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a real concern, and I think maybe it's no coincidence that in an event where they're encouraging you to throw out your old device and get a new one, they're selling, you know, how they strive to be environmentally friendly and recycle old devices.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. It's time. I'm clearly going to get a new iPad. Whether it's a refurbished iPad Air 2 without a camera bump, or a new 9.7-inch iPad Pro, remains to be determined. But it's clearly time for a new iPad. Which will mean, in the amount of time that I've owned my MacBook Pro, I'll have had 2 iPhones. I'll have upgraded the iPhone twice, and I'll be on my first upgrade of an iPad. It's interesting how the spending more money on the mobile devices than on the traditional computers. So
speaking of the phone, then they announced the SE, which we had talked about last week, the small phone.
Yeah, so you did not lead your friend astray.
Yep. And I told her Monday night, they announced your phone today. Pre-order it Thursday.
Which one do you think she'll get?
I don't know.
I mean, obviously she's going to get the SE, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they... trying to remember if they had...
They're still... So I actually found it interesting. I wasn't... You know, I hadn't really read the rumors too closely. I thought they might come up with a new design. I thought it might resemble, you know, the 6 and 6S design.
Mm-mm.
It's interesting that it's all... I mean, it's the same parts from the 5S.
I mean, to some extent, it kind of makes sense, right? Because all the machinery they had to build those phones... is still sitting around in a factory somewhere, right?
Yep.
In some Foxconn factory somewhere, there's all those machines that probably now have excess capacity. So, mm-hmm. And the machines that make the 6 and 6S phones probably don't have the same amount of capacity. So, to some extent, I think it makes a lot of sense that they'll do that.
So they did upgrade it a little bit. Did you notice this? And this, I think, has been one of your complaints, like, now it has, what do they call them, matte chamfered edges.
Yeah.
So it's not the slick metal edges of the 5S.
Well,
it's going to be a little less slippery.
Maybe. I don't know if it'll be less slippery or not. I think the boxiness of the design is what constitutes the slipperiness.
Yeah.
Because the contact points between the phone and your hand are minimized. The curved edges...
Right.
And there's, you know, the area of contact with your hand is greater. But it does look a little different. It does come with the 12 megapixel camera, right? So it comes with the new camera.
And no bump.
And no bump. Right? So, you know, that's, you know. That's brilliant.
It's unfortunate they're still pushing the 16 gigabyte low-end phone. I understand that now when we're talking about the low-end model, they wouldn't upgrade it, but man, every day that they're still selling these 16 gig phones is disappointing.
Yeah, I really, Apple should, you know, feel a little shame for every 16 gig phone that they sell. I really think they're doing their customers a disservice by doing that. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're going to buy an iPhone SE, please, for the love of God, buy the 64 gig model.
It's not even a consideration. It's not even an option.
Just buy it. Trust us.
You should have to sign like an agreement if you buy a 16 gig phone that you will never, ever complain about space on your phone to anyone ever again, as long as you live.
Yeah. If only that were true.
Cause at this point, there's no question that you will have problems.
Yes. Every person I've ever given advice to about a phone, I've always told them to buy the 32 or the 64 gigabyte version. And to a T, every person who has done so has never complained to me. Every person who has not done so has complained to me. And whenever they're all in a room together, the people who complain elicit comments from the other people, like, oh yeah, Matt told me to buy the big one and man, it seemed like such a waste of money. But, you know, now that I think about it, I don't even... You know, I've never, like, run out of space. And they go and look, and they're like, oh, and I've still got, you know, 10 gigs free or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people without all the space are kind of seething in anger, right? It's a classic example of, you know, paying for quality is never, you know, you soon forget the pain of the extra money. But buying a cheap one, all you remember is the pain from the cheap one.
Right. And you don't, it's not counteracted by the fact you saved $100 a year ago.
No, because a year passes, you don't remember the $100, right? You wasted that eating out at Chili's, right?
And most people who have dealt with the pain of not being able to upgrade because they don't have enough space, getting rid of apps, deleting photos, if you could allow them to give you $100 and double the size of their phone,
they'd do it in a heartbeat.
No question.
Yeah.
So
But
it's Apple. Like, I don't blame people, especially non-tech savvy people, for making poor choices like that. I blame Apple.
even if it was just a 24 gig model, just 8 gigabytes more would ease the pain.
Yep.
Tremendously. And it would still create plenty of distance for them to charge $100, you know, from the base model to the one step up model.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Apple.
So did you upgrade yet? iOS 9.3 was out. You didn't?
No.
Oh.
Come on.
So we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Right? And I know your stance, but then after we were looking at it Monday night and I turned on Night Shift and we went, ooh.
Yeah.
Then I was like, I think Matt's going to upgrade immediately just to get Night Shift. I was wrong.
No, I've been holding out. I really, you know, I need the internet to test it for me for a couple days.
Okay.
My guess is by next week's podcast, probably my ancient iPad will be upgraded. And undoubtedly by the podcast after that, my phone will be upgraded.
Okay.
And in fact, I'm also watching now. It's about time to start thinking about upgrading to El Capitan.
Hmm.
I mean, for people who know me, they know, wow, if Matt's actually upgrading his Mac OS, it might be time.
All right. Well, I, Monday afternoon, did a force refresh to see if the update was there, and it was, and I installed it, and so far, so good.
So basically, you spam the button until you could
update. I did. I only had to hit it once. I wouldn't have sat there. It was ready. I mean, they must have pushed it like right after the event Monday.
Well, they undoubtedly pre-delivered it to their content delivery network, right. You know, a day in advance.
Right? So they flipped the switch immediately.
And you've had no problems.
Yeah, nothing. I have had problems upgrading iOS in the past.
Is your Bluetooth stack any better?
I haven't noticed.
Is that because you haven't used Bluetooth?
Or I've only used my headphones once, and I guess if I recall, they did connect immediately, but I don't know. I'd have to do some testing.
Yeah. Well, that'd be an interesting question to think about. So,
Night Shift is the most interesting feature to me. That's the main reason I upgraded. I spend a lot of time staring at my phone in the dark late at night. I think I do believe studies that it's unhealthy for you to stare at a glowing screen before you go to sleep.
Yeah, put the phone down and just go to sleep, Scott.
Yeah.
That's the right answer.
So I've been trying it the last couple nights, and it's cool. And it is...
It's better?
Yeah, it's less painful.
Yeah. Well, soon I'll be there.
All right.
So, okay. Anything else?
I think that's all I got.
All right. Another good podcast.
Talk to you later.